There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon. And once again, I am so glad that you are joining me for some classic cardboard conversation on this podcast. And let's think about some classic cardboard moments. Remember when you were a kid and you're collecting baseball cards or any sport cards, and you actually traded cards? You know, you could still trade cards these days. I know most people try to make a buck off of them. But you would trade cards with your friends. You were trying to collect maybe your favorite player or favorite team. And it was a strictly numbers trade, you know. I've got one of these that I want. Here, I'll give you two of these for one of those. And you would acquire the card or cards that you wanted, and you called it a good trade. And even when you started factoring in cash value to cards, so maybe when you got a little older or collecting cards was less of a hobby and it started becoming more of a business for you, all right, instead of just a number of cards, you had to equal the cash value or the book value of a card. Say, all right, I want that card my friend has. It's valued at $5. So I've got to come up with $5 of equal value, or if you were really in need for that card, you would overpay for it. I'll give you $8 worth of cards if you give me that one $5 card. And sometimes you'd win the trade, sometimes your friend would, or maybe you didn't care. You just got that card that you wanted. Little did you know, you were honing your skills on being a sports general manager, because whether it's acquiring something that you need or you're working around a salary cap, value or no value, even when you were, say, 8 or 9 years old, yes, you were a general manager in training. And chances are your baseball card trades were more sound and better, got you better results than some of the professional sports GMs in their trades. But I bring that up because as sports has evolved, as the hobby has evolved, as certainly fantasy sports has evolved, and now, you know, legal gambling on sports has evolved over the last 2 or 3 years, I think a lot of people forget how big of a deal a trade really is. You know, with baseball cards, you would just trade one for the other, or you trade a bunch to get the one that you wanted. And likewise in fantasy sports, you know, you're changing your lineup every day or every week, whatever the case is, and you check a box and you trade this guy or you cut that guy and sign another guy. And you even hear general managers in sports talking about the players involved in trades, kind of like they're commodities, you know, like they're things you find on a shelf at the grocery store. Well, I traded this Kraft macaroni and cheese for 2 boxes of Velveeta macaroni and cheese. That's really how dehumanizing it can be sometimes. Well, we got some assets and some future assets. No, you're trading humans, and humans who may have extended family, or maybe they're married or they got kids, and all of a sudden their life's turned upside down. They're moving from New York to Nashville, or Nashville to Seattle, or, you know, whatever the case is. And, you know, it's pretty traumatic for, you know, some of these people. And it always has been. Once when I was working for the Tampa Bay Lightning as the director of broadcasting, I actually did 2 or 3 podcasts about the trade deadline and what was it like for players when they first got traded. And you'd have some pretty funny stories that came along the way. But more often than not, it was, you know, oh, I was surprised. I was shocked. It was pretty upsetting for my wife and kids and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, when you realize the human element to trades, you realize it's so much more than just a transaction, like you're messing with people's lives. So trades have always been a big thing in sports. And you can go back, you know, well into the previous couple of centuries. You know, if somebody got moved from Team A to Team B, it was a pretty big deal. And before the age of social media and even just the internet in general, you would find out about these trades perhaps on your local sports cast on television or radio, especially if it involved a local player, a national newscast, so an ESPN, or if it's a really big trade, you know, think the Wayne Gretzky trade from Edmonton to Los Angeles that rocked the nation of Canada. That was top story back in August of 1988. It could be, you know, found in that way, or perhaps you read about the trade in the newspaper. That's how I found out about the trade between the Blue Jays and Padres back in the winter of 1990. Roberto Alomar, Joe Carter coming to Toronto for Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez. Such a big deal back then. But if you dial it back even more, what did you have before the internet? What did you have before constant wall-to-wall coverage with ESPN and Fox Sports and the like? And even the local sports cast or the newspaper? Well, you had the baseball card. And that is how you may have found out that a team went from player A to player B. And today we're going to talk about the lifespan of the traded set. This was actually a suggestion from one of our listeners in our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains a while back. And I saw it and I said, yeah, we got to take a look at this. Because you'll discover there's an interesting history in the traded set. In many ways, traded baseball cards go back to the late 1800s. Although I think we can all agree that the quote-unquote modern day traded card started in 1972. It started as a neat addition to what was becoming a rather static base set, a factory set. It became a marketing hook when Topps suddenly saw competition in 1981. And then it basically became first edition cards. You didn't really care about the 125 or so players who were traded from Team A to Team B. You were looking for that key rookie card. You were looking for that Roger Clemens card or that Bo Jackson card, the Barry Bonds 86 Topps traded card. So what if Jim Leland's the new manager of the Pirates? Whoop-de-freaking-do. Give me that Barry Bonds card, baby. That's what you were looking for. And that's what the traded sets actually pretty much devolved into. And even though traded or update sets or high series sets are not as dominant or as influential in the hobby now, they still serve a purpose. And most of it is a marketing and a sales purpose. Again, because of social media and the internet and our constant connectivity to breaking news, we often find out about trades before the actual athlete who's getting traded finds out. But there is still a good reason to have update sets and high number sets, basically the new version of the traded set, which came out in its current form 49 years ago. And that actually leads me nicely into some future topics. As you know, Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. And our next program, Friday, March the 26th, we're going to go back to 1972. So we'll talk a little bit about, yes, the seven traded cards that were in that set. And there's one notable player who wasn't included in that. We'll actually talk about that today. But we'll talk about what was a genre-changing decision by the Topps Chewing Gum Company to change the look and feel and the message that baseball cards gave starting in 72, it would become more of a factor in the design of baseball cards, certainly in 1973 and then later editions. That, of course, would be the action shot. Many fewer posed shots. Action shots were all the rage back then. And, of course, the 72 top set is legendary for its 1972 style. The only thing missing from 72 tops is platform shoes and bell bottoms. It is a very funkified 1972 look. And if Topps' goal was to create a product that reflected the times, they hit the nail on the head in 1972. Now, why are we going to look at 72 Topps? Simply because it is the design of the 2021 Topps Heritage set. And we'll be reaching out to our friend Nick Deonte. Hopefully, we'll be able to get him on the program to talk about not just some new Topps products, but also taking a look at how the hobby has changed. And boy, has it changed. I've talked about this. Over the last year, we weren't quite so sure what was going to happen when everything shut down pretty much a year to the day with COVID. And we're still struggling to get out of it. We're making a lot of progress, but we're still going to be dealing with it for the next few months. But the hobby has definitely flourished for better and for worse. And we'll talk about that with Nick. Also on the docket, we're going to take a look at the foodstuffs of baseball cards. This will likely be our first show in April, as I've been able to collect through some cardboard donations and also some purchases the co-opted baseball cards of many years, where companies would align themselves with a product such as Coca-Cola or maybe Twinkies. We've talked about breakfast cereals too. So, you know, you've had your post-cereal baseball cards, but also some interesting restaurant chain connections. Burger King is one, McDonald's another. And I've been able to find some even Denny's. They had some pretty big releases of holographic baseball cards back in the mid-90s, tied in with their Grand Slam breakfast. So we'll take that unique look at a unique market, the foodstuff angle of sports cards, which really blossomed in the late 70s and throughout the 80s and into the 90s. And I'm going to go through my personal collection and try to find some ridiculous foodstuff connections. There's going to be some. Because like I said, there's the easy ones, the fast food, the sodas, the breakfast cereals. And then there are some you're looking at. It's just like, really? They made a baseball card too? Yes. You know, once upon a time, about 30 years ago, everybody made their own baseball card. So that is what is upcoming following this program. So be on the lookout for that. And also be on the lookout for some changes to Wax Ecstatic. You'll notice one starting with this program. I normally do a handful of player biographies at the end of the program based on cards that I pull from packs or sets or collections that we're discussing. And we're going to still continue to do that, but just to streamline the program a bit, because as you may have discovered, I tend to ramble. I can talk. And sometimes I get so in-depth with some of these player profiles that, you know, you're spending 30 or 40 minutes talking about four baseball cards. So what we're going to do, starting with this program, is trim that down a little bit to three players. So three cards that we randomly pull from whatever collection we're talking about. And we will title that the bottom of the order. So call it the 7, 8, 9 hitters, if you will. But that will be our signal that we'll be wrapping up the program in 20 or 30 minutes, but still should be fun for all of our listeners. I know it's fun for me. I really enjoy digging up some of the information about some of the players that we unearth in these collections. And in today's program, we've unearthed three interesting players covering the broad spectrum of traded and update sets. From the 1974 Topps updates, Steve Stone, former Cy Young Award winner and a longtime broadcaster in the Chicago area. From the 1988 Topps traded set, speaking of a Chicago-based pitcher, Black Jack McDowell. We've got his rookie card from 1988 we'll talk about. And speaking of rookies, the 1992 rookies set from Pinnacle. No, not Donruss, Pinnacle. We're going to talk about Pat Mahomes. No, not the Kansas City Chiefs quarterback, his dad, Pat Mahomes, Sr. We all know about Patrick Mahomes, Jr., if you will. But let's talk a little bit about Pat Mahomes, Sr. So we'll do that at the end of today's program. That should be fun. Also, be on the lookout for some not-so-subtle changes, including our YouTube page. I mentioned this in the video that we posted yesterday that was previewing our look at updated sets. I have now created a YouTube channel on a different channel than the previous one. The previous one was linked to my personal Gmail account. I started getting a lot of followers. That was great. The problem is I want to separate my personal account from this program. So there is a new Wax Ecstatic account. It's called waxandgumstains@gmail.com. So if you are subscribed to the YouTube channel that features a headshot of my ugly mug, then you may want to unsubscribe from that, because honestly, I'm not posting anything there anytime soon. If you want to follow Wax Ecstatic, just type in Wax Ecstatic and look for the channel that has the Wax Ecstatic logo. Or again, you can just type in the email address, waxandgumstains@gmail.com. That also means we've got a new email address as well. So if you have any questions, suggestions about the program, or if you'd like to make cardboard donations, let's start steering you that way, waxandgumstains@gmail.com. One other quick thought about the YouTube channel. I just want to let you know that, of course, YouTube does not make it easy to just merely transfer videos from one account to the other. So what I had to do was download all the videos I wanted to keep and then upload them back to this new Wax and Gum Stains channel. So what I decided to do was move all of the HD versions of the videos, which there were about 26 or 27 of them. And then there were a handful of SD versions that featured vintage packs that had a lot of views. So I moved those over. So we moved about 30 videos over. The problem is when you upload them, and especially when you upload them in bulk, they upload out of order. So you'll notice 30 videos on this channel just kind of scattered around. So I apologize for that. You may have to do some searching for the most recent videos. But starting now, because we're posting the videos there now, every video that gets posted will be coming out in chronological order there. But make sure that you share that message with your friends. Those who were subscribing to the old channel, you want to subscribe to the new one, because that is where all the videos will be going. And also, be on the lookout for a new website. Yes, I have secured the domain for waxandgumstains.com. Right now, there's nothing there. And that is by design. I want to make sure I get the website right. I want to make sure it's got the content that you want on there. As I've said before, this program was just this creation out of boredom a little over 4 years ago. We want to try to turn it into something. So while we've successfully cranked out about 180 podcasts over the last 4 years, we want to build around it. And I want to build the right website. So I will be tweeting out on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline. I'll send out a link to a SurveyMonkey survey soon, a quick five-question survey, just kind of putting the feelers out there. Hey, what would you want to see on a Wax Ecstatic webpage, or website, I should say? And we're going to spend a few weeks to build that out and build it up right, because what we want to do is go beyond the podcast, but be a nice landing zone for collectors, not just fans of the show, but for those who are interested in collecting. Maybe you've been reinvigorated after the COVID lockdowns to go rummaging through your closets and drawers and finding those old baseball cards. And we'll have some fun stuff built around that too. So in addition to the podcast you're getting every other Friday, there'll be something else, a content piece or two that comes out in the time in between our podcast postings. So A lot happening here at Wax Ecstatic. New YouTube channel, make sure you subscribe to that. New email, waxandgumstains@gmail.com. And coming soon, a new website at waxandgumstains.com. And we're going to design that and take our time and make sure that we get it right. Rolling that out, hopefully within the next month or so, we'll be able to get that up and running. And we'll also highlight, you know, individual collectors, some stores as well. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with that. And one other good thing about this website that I'm working on, all the things that I normally mention in this program, such as how frequently our podcast is, what our Twitter handle is, how you can make cardboard or cash donations, what I call housekeeping, we will be able to cut those constant mentions of all of the above because it's going to be living on the website. So I know there are some people who are just sick and tired of me spending 10 or 15 minutes every program talking about, you know, paypal.me/waxecstatic, or, you know, here's where you can reach out to me if you want to make a cardboard donation, stuff like that. You have screamed, you have hollered, you have cried, and I have listened. So that will be factored into the website as well. So we'll be able to focus more on the cards that we're talking about, and a little less on some of the housekeeping notes here. And that'll help make the program run a little smoother and probably a little shorter, which is a good thing for all of us. I appreciate everybody who listens and everybody who especially tunes in for each podcast from start to finish. But even I know, just talking for an hour and 45 minutes at times, that can be laborious for me. I can only imagine what it's like to listen to me talk for an hour and 45 minutes. So we're going to trim it back just a little bit. Still be entertaining, still be fun, still dive into the shoe boxes and the plastic pages and the top loaders that we all have our collections in. But just to try to make it an enjoyable experience, get caught up in the right times too with social media and digital media. And also, honestly, to make me feel like I'm getting my money's worth with my marketing master's degree that I am working on. I am now Google Analytics certified, so watch out, folks. I'm somewhat dangerous with this knowledge. Much like I'm dangerous with the knowledge of Topps traded sets and traded and update and rookie sets in general. Again, this was a really fun a topic to dive into because it's part of the hobby. As I mentioned, it's not as influential as it used to be, but there's still a key role for the update sets, the high series sets, and traded cards in general. And how it all came together is pretty interesting because I think we all recall a time, 30 or so years ago, you'd go into your favorite hobby shop, or maybe you're at your local card show, and somebody had boxes and boxes and boxes of traded sets and update sets and rookies sets. And, you know, they were fun little sets to buy because even if you knew there was a top name rookie in those sets, you know, you could get those neat little, if it was in the case of Topps 132 card set, you know, for what, $8, $10 retail price. And it was just kind of neat to be able to buy a complete set for just that small amount of money. And somehow you felt fulfilled, didn't you? You know, you were working all year long on pulling together that 792 card base set. But for the small price of $10, I have the update set. It's like uploading or updating that app on your phone or downloading the patch, you know, to your favorite video game. You have the original, but now, yes, you're up to date. It's like you've been vaccinated. Ah, I'm good to go now. So, you know, I remember that as a child going into the baseball card stores and being able to pick up these little sets. You know, that's where many of us think of where the traded set started. But the history goes way back, even before 1972. And there's a very interesting blog on the Sabre Baseball Card Research Committee blog. posted a couple of years ago, Jason Cards put out this very lengthy, very well-researched blog about the history of traded cards. And he makes an argument that traded cards could, if you really wanted to, you could trace it all the way back to the late 1880s. And we're talking old Judge tobacco cards. And even after that, T206 cards, various cards that were produced at that time. And I think the basic argument is, while these companies that were producing these cards, since, you know, this was a pull to get mostly minors involved in tobacco use, or because tobacco use was often linked to the redneck, backwoods, farm boy appeal to the sport of baseball. You know, baseball was not glamorous. It was not loaded with stars until the 1920s. You know, Babe Ruth and the Yankees really kind of set the tone for what a baseball player was. A baseball player could be a popular, well-paid, world-class athlete, where prior to the 1920s, baseball teams were typically hicks from the sticks who couldn't find a real job. And, you know, the best they could do was play the sport. So, you know, whatever the reason that you might have collected some of these old Judge or T206 cards back in the day, you certainly didn't want an old card in the package of tobacco or cigarettes or cigars that you were getting. And the companies that made these, you know, actually did go out of their way to update certain cards from year over year if a player was with a new team. And one example that the Sabre Baseball Cards blog points out is the T205 set from 1911. You had, let me see, who is the player here? David Sheen, who played with the Boston Rustlers. That was a predecessor to the Boston Braves. The Braves had a ton of different team nicknames a little over 100 years ago. So he's with the Boston Rustlers in 1910. He gets traded to the Chicago Cubs in 1911. And the T205 set, if you will, the first series features Sheen with the Boston logo, and it says Rustlers on top. And then the later series, if you will, it's the same picture of Sheen. It's the same autograph. It's essentially the same card, but with a different logo. You've got the Cub Bear logo, and it says Cubs instead of Rustlers. And, you know, there's another example here. George Graham, same thing here, as he has moved from the Boston Rustlers to the Chicago Cubs as well. And the blog points out several other examples, including Nat LaJoie with the 1914 and 1915 Cracker Jack sets. Also the Gowdy baseball sets from 1933. Guys such as Lefty O'Doul, who went from the Brooklyn Dodgers to the New York Giants. And in the same set, you have two versions of Lefty O'Doul. You have one pictured with the Dodgers and then one pictured with the Giants. And, you know, there's other examples, Diamond Stars from the mid-1930s, even 1951 Topps, Gus Zernial. We've talked about him in the 91 Archives show a while back. Gus Zernial went from the Chicago White Sox to the Philadelphia A's. But you'll notice if you have the Topps Redbacks from 1951, there's a version of Zernial with a White Sox letter C on his cap. The Athletics version, there's no C on his cap. It's just a plain hat, and that is all. As well as a mention that he was traded to the Philadelphia A's earlier in this year. But it's not an error card. It's just a variation because it's the same number of the card. It's just somewhere along the line. Once word got out that he was traded, Topps decided to fix things up a bit. And again, this blog points out some numerous updated cards. I think one of the best examples, other than a mention of a player getting traded on the back of a card, are cards that either flat out said on the front, and you even saw this going into the 1980s, you know, the little quotation marks, now with, you know, whatever team the player was traded to. Or, as an example, some OPG cards from the early 1970s. You would have, like, Al Downing went from the Brewers to the Dodgers, and you have a picture of him in his Brewers uniform, but it says Dodgers at the top of the card and some text added, you know, right above his head. It says recently traded to Dodgers. So you had those examples. Or you had the examples of a player like Frank Robinson and the legendary 1966 Topps Frank Robinson card, where Robinson is clearly wearing his old Reds uniform, but he doesn't have a hat on. And the card identifies him as playing for the Baltimore Orioles. And that was pretty standard back in the day, where a player, especially if he was selected by one of the expansion teams in the 1960s, you would just have the name of the team on there in the player's jersey, you know, word mark or logo on a cap, just blotted out. And that was your indication, okay, this guy was either traded, in the case of Frank Robinson, or he was drafted by this expansion team. And that, in many ways, is a quote-unquote traded card. So I agree to some extent with the Sabre Baseball Cards blog that, yes, in many ways, players getting traded were somehow noted, whether it was a revision, you know, a change in logo or a change in a jersey, or if it was just flat out text, something stamped on the front of a card or something added to the player bio on the back. From the late 1800s up through 1971, in many cases, there was some very simple acknowledgement that the player is no longer on the team he was with the previous season. But where I differ from this is that the true traded card really didn't come around until 1972. Now, why do I call this the true traded card or the true traded set? Because for the first time, starting in 1972, a card manufacturer went out of its way to set aside cards to tell the general public, this player is now on a separate team. So prior to 1972, any revisions or any acknowledgments of a player being traded to another team was really more of a public service. It was an editorial process. It was updating you on what's going on. And that was it. It was, like I said, just kind of a public service. Hey, this guy is wearing Yankee pinstripes, but guess what? He's now playing for the Dodgers. You know, something like that. That's basically what they were doing. But in 1972, Topps saw a way to take the traded players and turn it into a marketing vehicle. Now, part of this is because as players were becoming unionized and as there were labor negotiations that started causing trouble, in fact, the beginning of the 1972 season was delayed a couple of weeks because of a player strike, Topps kind of saw that players moving from one team or another, while it's always happened, it may be going on an uptick as players and owners fight over player movement rights, to put it simply. But also, in 1972, or I should say the winter of 1971, there were some pretty notable players who were moved. Most notably, the aforementioned Frank Robinson. Now his pinnacle days as a ball player going down a little bit, but it was a pretty big deal that Frank Robinson went from Baltimore to the Dodgers. Another example, Joe Morgan going from Houston to Cincinnati, or arguably the biggest example, Steve Carlton, lefty, after getting into contract squabbles with the St. Louis Cardinals, dumped on the Philadelphia Phillies, where Steve Carlton would be responsible for nearly 60% of the Phillies' wins their handful of wins in 1973. And Topps decided to take seven of the biggest trades and make separate cards. And these were cards that you could slot into your base set. That's how they were numbered. So behind your St. Louis Cardinals Steve Carlton card, if you were fortunate to pull a Steve Carlton Phillies traded card in a later series set, you could just drop that right in there. And you had a before and after comparison, basically. And the 72 Topps traded cards were very basic, but like the 72 Topps set, very gaudy in the sense that you had the Electric Company Dynamite comic book approach that was at the top of the card that was eliminated. And at the bottom of the card in this military grade text, it was almost stamped on. Boom! Traded. You know, it was almost like a scarlet letter. Steve Carlton, you're with the Phillies. God bless your soul. So, you know, there was this very clunky look to it. But it was effective. Topps was able to take what was a routine part of the business of baseball and turn it into something kind of special. And this was one of the many changes that came to the 72 Topps set that would point the set and baseball cards in general in a very different direction moving forward from 1972. Now, a couple of interesting notes from the 72 traded cards. Again, only seven trades were highlighted, including the note that the All-Star infielder Jim Fregosi was traded from the California Angels to the New York Mets. There's not a traded card for the other big-name player involved in that deal. That, of course, Nolan Ryan. So we are stuck with the legendary 72 Topps Nolan Ryan card, where you can see he's wearing Mets pinstripes, but also a childlike airbrushed Angels cap with the lowercase a on it. Another notable missing card from the 72 Topps traded editions, Charlie Williams went from the New York Mets to the San Francisco Giants. Who did the Mets get in return? Some guy named Willie Mays. And yeah, I know Willie Mays in 1972 was not the Willie Mays of 1962. But he's still Willie Mays. You know, that's kind of a big deal when the Giants cut ties with arguably their biggest or best-known franchise player. So, yeah, there were a few things missing from the 72 Topps cards, but it was definitely a good trial balloon. But not good enough for Topps to do it every year. In fact, strangely, Topps would do this every other year through 1976. So you had some traded cards in 1974, which was unique because 1974 was the first year that Topps created the factory set, where while you're thumbing through your JCPenney catalog while sitting on the can, if you decided, you know, I'm going to spend $6 to get this 660 card set with those new Washington National League former San Diego Padres in there, if you got that set, you could, through packs, add these traded cards and slot them right in behind the regular base set cards. Same thing happened in 1976, where you had traded cards for several of the biggest names that were moved in the winter of 1975. And that was really the dawn of the free agency movement. So again, the timing of this by Topps was rather well timed. There were a lot of players that were going to be on the move. And of course, the most famous 1976 Topps traded card is Oscar Gamble, showing him wearing a Yankees cap, quashing part of that massive afro that he had. Of course, in reality, we would never see Oscar Gamble jam a Yankees hat over that afro like he had done previously while with the Cleveland Indians, simply because of George Steinbrenner's hair length rule. And there is a legendary story of once Gamble was traded to the Yankees, he landed in Tampa, and before he could get to the practice fields, he was taken straight to a barber, and that's where the afro died a very quick and quiet death. Now, strangely, you'd think that Topps has something going on here, and maybe they should continue that into the 1977 set, but they did not do it. And I say strangely because that's when the floodgates of free agency opened up. You now had hundreds of players taking advantage of the new free agency system, the end of the reserve clause, and signing contracts to join new teams all over the place. But I think Topps made the right decision not to do that, because had they made a second card that you would drop behind the base set card, the 77 Topps set would have gone from 660 cards to roughly 800 if you included players who signed free agent contracts and the new Toronto Blue Jays and the Seattle Mariners. That would have been an absolute mess and a disaster. And the 77 Topps set is already a masterpiece in revision artwork, as numerous cards feature player uniforms airbrushed on because of all the free agent moves and the expansion teams. So, strangely, Topps doesn't do this in the late 1970s, but they rightly do it in 1981. And this is where the traded set goes from a unique marketing throw-in to a factory set to a marketing hook. This is where Topps Traded becomes a must, because in 1981, Fleer and Donruss are rolling out their sets. All of a sudden, for the first time since 1955, Topps has competition. So what are they to do? Well, they decide to take their already impressive 726-card set, and they decide to expand it 132 cards. That's right, a mammoth, if you include the traded cards, a mammoth 858-card set in 1981. And the traded set would feature not only players traded from one team to another. So I have, for an example, in the video that I showed, I pulled one of my traded cards, a Gaylord Perry card. Of course, Perry was on the move practically every 6 months back then. But I found one where he's with the Atlanta Braves, spring training, 1981. And I can think of another example right off the top of my head, Raleigh Fingers, who was with the San Diego Padres in 1980. That's where he's featured with the base set. But after a quick stop over in St. Louis, he's in Milwaukee in 1981. So there's Raleigh in his Brewers uniform. Another good example, former Padre Dave Winfield signing that big free agent contract with the Yankees. So if you wanted to see Dave Winfield in Yankee pinstripes, the only place to get it, yep, 1981 Topps. And that was a selling piece. That was a pitch for Topps. Because Fleer and Donruss, even though they were competition to Topps, they were so far behind the well-established Topps Chewing Gum Company that there were many flaws with the cards that Fleer and Donruss were putting out in 1981. Most notably, pictures of players from, in some cases, 3 or 4 years before. And Raleigh Fingers is a great example, because the Raleigh Fingers 81 Fleer card not only shows him with the San Diego Padres, but also shows him wearing the 1978 San Diego Padres uniform. So that picture was taken either in the 1978 season or at best 1979 spring training before they donned slightly different uniforms. So Topps had an advantage. Hey, see your favorite stars in their new uniforms, courtesy of Topps Traded, something that you would just add on to your already impressive Topps baseball cards. And once Fleer and Donruss got their act together and they started putting out better cards in 1984 is certainly the high watermark for them. But, you know, once they struggled through the early 80s and finally found their footing in 84, they decided to get in on the action as well. Fleer Update was a great update set. Not only did it feature players in their new uniforms for those who were traded, but Fleer would use the update set to not once but twice scoop tops on some big rookies, most notably Roger Clemens and Kirby Puckett. Now, Clemens and Puckett would get their due in the 85 set, and those cards are still very valuable. And yeah, Topps would strike back by including Mark McGwire in his United States Olympic baseball card. But it was a big scoop for Fleer to come in with Puckett and Clemens, two no doubt stars in the 1984 update set. And even though Topps traded featured rookie cards, or should I say second versions of rookie cards, great example from 1981, both Fernando Valenzuela and Tim Raines. Valenzuela and Raines were featured on those multiplayer, the Andrew Ridgely rookie cards, as I like to call them. They were featured on those multiplayer cards. Well, Fernando, of course, helping lead the Dodgers to a World Series championship in 1981. Tim Raines adding some speed to an already impressive, powerful young Expos lineup. Well, they both needed their own card, right? So you would have that. And of course, the best example, 1982, Cal Ripken going from the multiplayer card to the solo rookie card in the traded set. And I don't think it's an accident that Topps abandoned the multiplayer cards in 1983 when it came to rookies. But rookies were all the rage starting in 1983. And it continued in 1984. Donnie Baseball, Don Mattingly, a big reason why. Ron Kittle, Ryan Sandberg, Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, the aforementioned Clemens and Gwynn and Puckett. You know, all of a sudden now, you've got this plethora of young stars, and the hobby shifts abruptly to emphasizing rookies. So traded sets and update sets started to be more of just a showcase of young stars, prospect cards, rather than showcasing who got traded from Team A to Team B. And Donruss at this time is going, you know what? Screw traded. We just want rookies. And they created the Donruss rookie set, which, as opposed to Topps and Fleer, where Topps and Fleer basically just put out the same kind of card, Topps used a different card stock. They used a sharper white card stock. Fleer used a glossier card stock. Well, Donruss did a slight change. They would adjust the color palette on the front and sometimes the backs as well from their base set. So nothing too earth-shattering, just a little bit of a tweak here or there. But by the mid-1980s, this is where the marketing advantage for Topps in the early 80s now shifts to three companies trying to outdo each other with notable rookies. And then it would continue to grow from there with Upper Deck. Of course, we all know how Upper Deck completely changed the landscape in 1989. Well, they would do it again by adding a new twist to an old tactic, and that is adding a second series. And they didn't call it second series. It was high series or the high numbers. The base set for Upper Deck cards 1 through 700. Well, they would introduce the high series cards 701 through 800 midway through the season. And while that would feature traded cards, and of course the photography that was featured in Upper Deck, that was a big draw to it. So especially 1989, you wanted that Nolan Ryan Texas Rangers card because of some great photographic effects and, you know, also getting to see Nolan Ryan toss a football as opposed to Nolan Ryan, former Houston Astro, which was featured in the base set. So you have the quality of Upper Deck cards with some traded players, plus a couple of notable rookies that were coming up through the ranks, and Upper Deck raises the bar on the traded set. Well, now we're getting traded Sapulpa going on in the late 80s and into the early 90s, where again the focus shifts away from players getting traded to players who are going to be up-and-coming stars. And one example that we have in the video was the 1992 Pinnacle rookie set. Now remember, Pinnacle was the parent company of the Score set. So they didn't even want Score to have the rookie set here. They totally gave it to Pinnacle brand. And I found it interesting how the Pinnacle rookie set was packaged. Because when you look at the Topps traded sets, remember those kind of cube-shaped boxes, and you'd have 132 cards jammed in there. And because Topps used the white card stock, it was still thin. It wasn't a very thick card stock. So the cards would bow a little bit, and you'd have these somewhat wavy cards coming out of the box. You'd have to, you know, stack them up and then put, you know, a heavy book or a brick on top of it to kind of flatten them out. Or you'd have to put them all into those plastic pages, and boy, that was a real pain. You didn't want to do that. Well, the Pinnacle Rookies set, once you took the plastic wrapper off, you opened up the box. It wasn't just, you know, pulling a few flaps out and pulling the top off. The box is almost like a box of expensive breath mints, or you could even say a diamond ring. The way that it was folded, you know, it was like there was a treasure inside. But you couldn't see the treasure because there was a styrofoam jam in there. And what I mean by that is, you know, just this little slab of styrofoam that was placed on the top and the bottom of the cards to try to prevent the damage of the cards, which could happen, you know, in shipping. So all of a sudden, there's this premium to these rookie cards just in the packaging, plastic wrapping, a fancy box, cardboard at the top, or styrofoam at the top and bottom to try to protect the cards. And then when you look at the actual cards, you have very glossy, photograph-centric, works of art, gold foil, of course, everything in 1992 was just slathered in gold foil. And even, you know, an almost exclusive presentation in the numbers. It wasn't just card number one, it was one of 30, as if there were only 30 of these cards in existence, which of course in 1992 was not the case. There were actually probably 30 million of each set. But you can see where in such a short amount of time, basically in 20 years' time, what started as this kind of fun addition, small addition to a base set to highlight some of the biggest names that have moved from one team to another, had evolved into a subset that could be so granular. It was the 30 top rookies, as determined by the Pinnacle Company, in this very glossy, high-end, shiny project that came out. And I emphasize 30 because even the Donruss rookie set at the time, I believe, was 56 cards. So Donruss was taking the traded set and cutting it almost in half. And here comes Pinnacle going, well, you know what? We're going to take your rookie set. We're going to cut it by 40%. We're only featuring the best of the rookies, the prime cuts, the grade A tenderloin beef. It's amazing how it evolved, but also it got out of hand, much like everything else in the hobby in the early 1990s. Of course, Topps was still putting out the traded sets. In fact, they were selling traded cards in traded packs. So if you wanted to go the pack route, you could do that. Topps was still doing traded sets. Fleer was still doing updates. Donruss was still doing rookies. Upper Deck was still doing high series. But as technology evolved, you could get pictures of players in spring training or perhaps in their press conference showing them wearing their new uniforms. You could feature those on cards, or along with the progress of a company like Bowman, which was now focusing solely on prospects and future stars, you really didn't need the update sets as much as you needed, say, in the mid 80s. By the mid 90s, it was becoming passe again because of technology and really a desire for people to get more rookies as opposed to finding out who got traded from one team to another. But traded sets in many ways still exist, although they're not necessarily traded. They're they're high series cards now. In fact, you could argue a set such as Topps Opening Day, that could be a traded set, because any player that has moved from Team A to Team B and it wasn't noted in the base set, well, when the Opening Day cards come out, typically in May of every year, April or May of every year, well, you've got the player in his new uniform already there. Likewise, because of technology, you can Photoshop players into these new uniforms. Even rookies, you can do some creative artwork, much like Ken Griffey Jr.'s 89 Upper Deck card was. And those were the primitive days of Photoshop-like products. That was a picture of him with the Bellingham Mariners that they gussied up to make it look like he was with Seattle. But, you know, now the technology has come such a long way. I'm thinking of a guy like Tommy Pham, who was traded from the Rays to the Padres prior to the 2020 season. Not only did you have that trade, but the Padres doing a complete uniform overhaul, kind of doing this modernized throwback look to their brown and gold days of the 70s. Well, if you get the Topps Heritage card for Tommy Pham, it features him in the Padres pinstripes. And of course, by then you only had a limited number of spring training photographs before everything got shut down by COVID. So you can Photoshop, you can digitize, you can do anything to a picture of any player, whether it is a traded player or somebody who is going to get that call up from the minor leagues. Maybe he's never put on that major league uniform in reality, but you can make it look that way. So the true traded set, the update set, the rookie set, that's kind of gone by the wayside, but it does live in different forms. You've got the Opening Day set. You do have a second series with Topps. You do have a high series with Topps Archives. Those are focused more on rookies and young stars who are making their way up. But if you needed an updated picture of a player with a new team, an established major leaguer who's gone from one team to another, certainly you can include that in one of the many various productions that Topps pushes out every year. So is there a true traded set? Are you getting packs of pure updated cards? No. But in terms of a Series 2 or a high series set, depending on, you know, which base set you're building that off of, the traded set, the rookie card, the update set, it still lives on just in a different form. But it's neat to see how what was just a duty to the fam, noting, yeah, this player went from one team to another, to a marketing hook starting in the 70s, but one that was used against the competition in the 80s, quickly turned into just another vehicle for rookie cards that you could only exclusively buy at your local card shop. And that has now devolved a little bit into glorified high series cards throughout various sets that Topps and their various brands put out there. So that is a history, a somewhat short history of the Topps traded, and not just Topps, I should say the traded and update cards. And I did find it very interesting, again, the Sabre baseball card blog making a case that, you know, traded cards in many ways went back to the 1880s. And again, yes, somewhat true, but I think the real traded card, the notion that you should go out of your way to create the second version of a card, really didn't start until 1972. And even in the last 49 years, it has evolved quite a bit. Well, let's take a look at the bottom of the order. Yep, here are the three players that we're going to be talking about in our look at some of these updated cards. And I'm actually going to go backwards in time. Normally, I would go chronological in order, but we're going to go backwards. We're going to start with the card that I pulled for the 1992 Pinnacle Rookies, Pat Mahomes. We call him Pat Mahomes Senior these days. He's only 50 years old. He's really not senior when you think about it. And his son, while technically he would be Pat Mahomes Jr., of course, he goes by Patrick Mahomes, the quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs. Boy, What a pro career he's already had. Won one Super Bowl, appeared in another one, losing out to Father Time and Tom Brady and the Buccaneers a few weeks back. But we all know about Patrick Mahomes. What about Pat Mahomes? Because I think it just gets overlooked. You know, we see the cute pictures of Pat Mahomes and Patrick Mahomes and Patrick Mahomes' mom when Pat Mahomes Sr., if you will, was with the Twins or with the Mets. And we all know the story. Yep, Dad used to play in the major leagues, but do you really know the story? And a lot of people really don't. And that's what we're going to try to cover here, because Pat Mahomes was quite the athlete, much like his son is, growing up in the Bryan, Texas area. Now, this would be Patrick LaVon Mahomes Sr., again, born in Bryan, Texas. He was a baseball, basketball, and football star in high school. And he began his professional career with the Elizabethton Twins. You have to say that very slowly. That is definitely a tongue twister there. In 1988, he was a starting pitcher and would eventually move his way up through the Twins organization, making his major league debut at the start of the 1992 season. And he did this on April 12th against the Texas Rangers, got a no decision, however, would pick up his first major league victory in his next start against the Seattle Mariners, an up-and-coming Mariners team. Of course, you had Ken Griffey Jr. and Jay Buhner, Randy Johnson at that time. I mean, quite the competition to go up against. And you can imagine, you're Pat Mahomes. You're signed by the Minnesota Twins in the late 1980s. You get up to the big league club, 1992, opening day, you're raising a banner. There's a World Series championship pennant, and you're going, man, this is good. I'm with a World Series champion, and we're going to do it again. And of course, we know that that's not exactly how it works out here. When Mahomes starts in 1992, he is a starting pitcher. However, not a very effective one here. Strikeout to walk ratio, almost 1-1. Gave up a lot of ground balls, which on the Metrodome turf was a bad thing because it was bouncing all over the place. Also, the Twins going downhill a little bit. A lot of people forget how old or experienced the 91 Twins were. And you started having some player movement. So the Twins would slide out from competition or, being a team that could contend. They started sliding from that status and would remain that way for almost 10 years at that point in time. And unfortunately, Mahomes kind of got caught up with that. So a ground ball pitcher with a depleted and younger, inexperienced infield, not a good thing on that Metrodome turf to give up ground balls. His earned run average ballooned a lot in his early years. Started only 13 games in 1992, started only 5, but appeared in 12 in 1993. Became a full-time starter again in 1994 with mixed results, but by the 1995 season, pretty much relegated to the bullpen. Would get a spot start here or there with the Twins, a team that he would remain with through the 1996 trade deadline, as he was traded from the Twins to the Boston Red Sox on August 26th in exchange for the ubiquitous player to be named later. That would turn out to be pitcher Brian Looney. Now, he appeared in 21 games, all in relief in the 96 and 97 seasons with Boston, a rather unimpressive 6.85 earned run average, and he was actually released prior to the end of the 1997 season. So he decides to go overseas. He plays for the Yokohama Bay Stars of the Nippon Pro Baseball League as he would pitch with them through the 1998 season. Now, where did all those adorable pictures of Mahomes Senior and Junior come from with the New York Mets? Well, thanks to a free agent contract that Mahomes signed in December of 1998 with the Mets. And in fact, it looked like a pretty damn good deal. He started off 8-0 in 1999 in 39 relief appearances, and also played a key part in the Mets' playoff drive. They would make it all the way to the League Championship Series, where they ran into the buzzsaw that was the Atlanta Braves at that time. During the postseason, 8 innings pitched, 2.25 earned run average, and he would continue to be a positive factor for the Mets. In the year 2000, 53 appearances, 5 starts, a respectable 5-3 record, and a somewhat decent 4.74 earned run average. However, he was actually left off the Mets playoff roster and did not appear in the 2000 World Series, the Subway Series with the New York Yankees. Now, he would become a free agent following the 2000 season, where a litany of rather unimpressive stops came about. He would pitch for the Texas Rangers in 2001, the Chicago Cubs in 2002, the Pittsburgh Pirates in 2003, and then spent quite a few years bouncing around in the minor leagues. Going to, let me see if I've got this list here, Nashville, Edmonton, Albuquerque, Las Vegas, Long Island, Sioux Falls, Syracuse, the Southern Maryland Blue Crabs, and he eventually ended up, the 2009 season would be his last, splitting time between the Sioux Falls and Grand Prairie clubs. Now, he was actually inducted in 2019 into the Sioux Falls Canaries Hall of Fame. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that the Sioux Falls Canaries Hall of Fame really doesn't have a whole lot to do with his playing days. Because that induction happened in 2019, I have a hunch it's more because of his son, Patrick Mahomes Jr., because looking at his Sioux Falls numbers in 2009, he had a 6.46 earned run average in 10 games. And let me see, some previous seasons too. He had a couple of decent seasons, 2007, 2008. But definitely, this guy, wasn't quite Roy Hobbs in the minor leagues. So, all right, we'll talk it up chalk it up to familial ties there as for why he's there. But that's okay. Of course, the father of Patrick Mahomes, the Kansas City Chiefs quarterback, that has been a big claim to fame for him. And what did Patrick Mahomes learn from his father in watching his father not only play Major League Baseball, but also, more importantly, go through that minor league grind? Well, there was an interview in Men's Health that Patrick Mahomes actually just did, just a couple weeks ago, where he talked about he was able to see and learn from his father grinding through the minor leagues. And he saw how incredibly valuable and how blessed you are to have any time in the major leagues. And that is one reason why, if it looks like Patrick Mahomes is having a good time with the Kansas City Chiefs, well, hey, he's the new face of the NFL. Move over Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady and every other young quarterback. I mean, this is Patrick Mahomes' league right now, and you've seen that impact on and off the football field. He was a big, big determining factor of changing the NFL's mindset with social issues, especially Black Lives Matters. So, this guy's got all sorts of influence. He's got a ton of money. He's actually a minority owner in the Kansas City Royals, and he is just soaking it up right now because, as he has said, nothing's really guaranteed in professional sports. You don't know how long it's going to last. And Patrick Mahomes Sr. was able to experience Major League Baseball, or baseball from the major league level, I guess you could say, for about 10 seasons with that little intervention in Japan in 97 and 98. But here's a guy who didn't have a spectacular career, but he was able to, take part in the major leagues and, make the best that he could of it. And you can bet that Patrick Mahomes is definitely trying to do that with his time in the NFL. Now let's go to a pitcher who also was a bit of a journeyman, but who had a lot more success. I remember him as one of the most dominant pitchers in the early 1990s. And I think he is one of the big reasons why the goatee came into style in the early 1990s. Now, granted, rock stars had goatees, movie stars had goatees, but there was just something really special, dare I say seductive. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there was just something special about the goatee of Blackjack, Jack McDowell of the Chicago White Sox. Now, we pulled his rookie card from the 88 Topps traded set. Jack McDowell, born in Van Nuys, California in 1966, had a pretty lengthy major league career and a pretty impressive one as well. A Cy Young Award winner in 1993, he led the American League in wins. Three-time All-Star from 1991 to 93. You know, the 93 Blue Jays, of course, get all the credit for being a powerhouse, back-to-back World Series winners. First time you had that since the late 70s with the New York Yankees. But I think a lot of people forget how good the team the Jays played in the ALCS, the Chicago White Sox in 1993, were. I'd love to do a deeper dive on what made the White Sox kind of fall apart in the mid-90s, because they seem to be a team on the rise. But for various reasons, I'm sure they just couldn't keep it all together. Now, McDowell attended Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks, California, drafted by the Boston Red Sox in 1984, opted not to sign, rather going to Stanford University, which certainly improved his draft status in future years. Co-freshman of the year in 1985, second-team All-American in 1986, third-team All-American in 1987, and oh yes, he won a College World Series with the Cardinal in 1987. So of course, the Chicago White Sox taking notes, they make McDowell the fifth overall pick in the draft, and after appearing in the minor leagues for only six games, makes his major league debut September 15th, 1987, seven shutout innings against the Minnesota Twins. The eventual world champion Minnesota Twins picks up his first win. Very impressive cup of coffee with the White Sox at the end of the 87 season, 3-0 record and a 1.93 earned run average. Not as sharp in 1988, although you could chalk that up mostly to the White Sox not being as sharp as well. 5-10, 3.97 earned run average in 26 starts. Also had to deal with some injuries as well. But by the early 1990s, one of the most dominant and dependable pitchers in the big leagues. He would record over 250 innings in each season in 91, 92, and 93. Fat chance that happens nowadays, right? Won 20 games in 1992, 22 in 1993. Like I said, led the American League in that category, won the Cy Young Award, and was a factor in getting the White Sox to the playoffs in 1993. First time in 10 years that the White Sox had made the playoffs, so that was a pretty big feat at that time. Now, from 1988 until 1995, he was one of the more dominant pitchers in the American League, mostly in Chicago, but in 1995, he would get moved to the Yankees, as he was traded for minor league pitcher Keith Heberling and outfielder Lyle Mouton, or is it Mouton? I now think I know why the White Sox were not as good after 1993. Thank you, Captain Obvious. So McDowell is with the Yankees for just 1 year, and it is a year to forget, despite a 3.93 earned run average and a 15-10 record, and helping the Yankees get back into the playoffs. It was their first playoff appearance since 1981. He is best remembered for an incident in July of 1995 against his former team, the White Sox, who were just pummeling him one day, second game of a doubleheader. Well, McDowell gets pulled from the game. He's walking back to the dugout. The Yankees fans, of course, razzing him the whole way. And McDowell just flips off the crowd. Ah, the one thing you don't want to do, right? And that led to McDowell's picture of him flipping off the crowd, landing on the back page of all the sports pages, but I believe it was the New York Daily News, which blessed him with the name the Yankee Flipper. Still one of the greatest headlines in New York sports history. It was a beauty. McDowell also, as of note, gave up the walk-off series-winning hit to Edgar Martinez in the 95 ALDS. So to all of the Mariners fans, you have Jack McDowell partially to thank for keeping the Mariners in Seattle, because that is, as it is well known, if it weren't for that 1995 playoff run, the Mariners could have relocated to any number of cities, because they never would have built T-Mobile Park after that, had it not happened. Now, after that rocky season with the Yankees, McDowell would move on to the Cleveland Indians, where he was a veteran presence, however, dealt with a lot of injuries and a lot of ineffectiveness. And he signed as a free agent with the Anaheim Angels in 1998. But again, injuries, again, ineffectiveness also creeping in. And his pro career was done in 1999 after getting released by the Angels. He dabbled in coaching for a little bit. He was the Ogden Raptors manager, the rookie league level team for the Los Angeles Dodgers in 2014. Also the manager of the Arizona League Dodgers in 2015. And later moved on to Queens University in Charlotte, North Carolina, head coach of the baseball team there from 2017 through the 2019 season. Now, while McDowell did not succeed at the coaching levels, at least certainly long term, he is a noted musician. In fact, one reason why that goatee was so popular, he's an alternative rock guitarist, as he played in a band called View. Had a couple of albums come out in 1989, 1992. View's biggest claim to fame, touring with the Smithereens. Love the Smithereens. Awesome. In 1992, he also formed a band called Stick Figure that released a couple of albums back in the mid-90s and early 2000s. So there you go. Jack McDowell, Black Jack McDowell. One of the most dominant pitchers in the early 1990s, and like I said, I think a big reason why the goatee became such a popular look for not just rock stars and movie stars, but athletes as well. Last but certainly not least, the traded card from the 1974 collection that I have, Steve Stone, Stoney. Who we used to joke, he was the guy who would wipe the drool off of Harry Carey's chin. Or, you know, when Harry would go off on one of his many tangents, it was poor Steve Stone who had to kind of clean up the mess. One incident I recall was Suzanne Summers throwing out the ceremonial pitch at Wrigley Field one day. And this is, you know, back in the 90s, you know, she was pushing the Thighmaster back then. And she's out there in a summer dress, and let's just say the wind was blowing in a little bit, blowing in and up her skirt, kind of blew her dress up just a little bit as she's delivering the pitch. Nothing blue, you know, it's not like you could see her underwear, but it showed off a little more leg than I'm sure she intended. And while this ceremonial pitch is being thrown, Harry goes, "Wow! I guess that Thighmaster works." And then, of course, you're Steve Stone. Well, how do you pick up after that? Yeah. "Well, Harry, today's starter for the Cubs is, this guy." So you often had a lot of Harry Careyisms followed up with, "Well, Harry," you know, just kind of, "let's change the topic, Harry." So Steve Stone, a native of South Euclid, Ohio, who was a star pitcher almost by accident. He actually wanted to be a catcher, but became a pitcher, I believe, in his big league or little league career, I should say. His father was his little league coach. For some reason, he had to change out his pitcher. He was running out of options. His son was catching. So he decided to just put his son on the mound, and what do you know? He was actually a pretty decent pitcher. And the rest, as they say, is history. Another interesting note about Steve Stone's father, Paul Stone, he was an insurance salesman who also once had the job of changing records in jukeboxes. I find that very interesting. Now, Stone would go on to play high school ball at Charles Brush High School. And he won several championships in numerous sports, including tennis. Also, he was a well-known golfer, and he was a ping pong champion, too. So don't take up ping pong with Steve Stone if you get the opportunity. Now, after his high school days at Brush High School, he would go on to Kent State University, where he was a pretty solid pitcher. for the team. All Mid-American Conference team member, named team captain as junior. And he also pitched in the Cape Cod League in the summer of 1968, was a standout for the volleyball, tennis, and bowling teams. Now, those are three separate teams. He didn't, there wasn't one team for all three sports. That would have been an interesting triathlon there. And he was, like I said, a standout pitcher. Well, one reason why he was a standout pitcher, he had a pretty good guy at the other end of the battery, some kid named Thurman Munson, who was the catcher for Kent State at the time. Graduate of 1970 with a teaching degree in history and government. Steve Stone was not just your average ball player. He was actually clean cut, clean shaved for much of his career. He would eventually grow out his hair and sport a mustache. But he was a clean cut, good Jewish boy, as they would say, Orthodox Jewish family and background they came from, and very well educated, as I mentioned. So he was definitely going against the grain from your typical ball player. Turned down an opportunity to play for the Cleveland Indians. That was a good choice by him in 1968, drafted in 1968 round, 16th round, but didn't sign with them. He was then later drafted in 1969 by the San Francisco Giants, was part of the Giants minor league organization from 1969 through 1971, and he would make his major league debut in the 1971 season and butted heads with manager Charlie Fox for numerous reasons. One, Fox was the old school, put your head down, nose to the grindstone kind of guy. And again, Stone was not that type of person. He was more of the highbrow, educated, clean cut ball player. Which, you know, even though he had a successful stint with the Giants in 1971, and some people were comparing him to another well-known Jewish pitcher, a childhood idol of Steve Stone, Sandy Koufax, that didn't quite work out. And the Giants could see that after the 1971 season, as he struggled a little bit in 1972. And dealt with some injuries as well, and eventually the Giants dumped him, along with teammate Kenny Henderson, going to the Chicago White Sox for Tom Bradley in the winter of 1972. Rather unforgettable, forgettable, 1973 season, where he went 6-11 with a 4.24 earned run average. Would go cross town to the Chicago Cubs in a deal along with teammate Steve Swisher for Ken Frailing, for not Mr. Cub, that's Ernie Banks, a legendary Cub, Ron Santo. A lot of people forget Santo played out his final days with the Pale Hose on the other side of town. So again, that trade was Stone, Swisher, and Frailing for Ron Santo. Also a player to be named later, Jim Kremel, sent to the Cubs to complete that deal. And a couple of decent seasons with the Cubs with a not-so-decent Cubs team. 74, a 4.14 earned run average, 75. He went 12-8 with a 3.95 earned run average. Now, with the dawn of the free agency starting, the free agency period, in 1976, Stoney was eligible for free agency, and he had decided to take advantage of that. Signing with the Chicago White Sox, he would sign a rather impressive deal with the White Sox, despite the fact that he was in pretty bad shape. He was dealing with a torn rotator cuff, but he refused surgery. He was into this holistic medicine and was actually undergoing cryotherapy to fix his arm. Well, despite this, and despite turning down offers from several other teams, the White Sox, took a gamble with him. And he had a decent 1977 season, going 15-12 with a 4.5 earned run average. And the lone downside to the 77 season, Stone gave up the only career home run by Dwayne Kuiper. Yes, the light-hitting second baseman for the Cleveland Indians. Kuiper had just one career home run in 3,379 at-bats. He would sign another one-year deal with the White Sox at a decent 78 season, and then finds himself in Baltimore signing a then pretty lucrative four-year deal worth $760,000 a year. Now, the good thing for Stone was he wasn't seen as the number one in Baltimore. You still had Jim Palmer there, but you also had some up-and-coming youngsters such as Scott McGregor, Mike Boddicker, and others coming up through the system. So in many ways, he was the number five guy in Baltimore. And even though he was number five in the rotation, he was number one on a lot of lists. In 1980, he would win the Cy Young Award in the American League, came in ninth in American League MVP voting. Of course, it's kind of hard to catch up to George Brett in 1980, but still a pretty impressive showing, as Stone went 25-7 in that magical 1980 season. Had a 3.23 earned run average and was also a horse pitching over 250 innings. He was the pitcher of the month in June of 1980, started and pitched three perfect innings in the All-Star game, which was at Dodger Stadium. And in fact, that's where a lot of people got to get to know Steve Stone. He was the star of the show in 1980. Now, he would continue to deal with some injuries, tendonitis that shelved him in 1981. He had a rough year that year, and he would retire due to that continuing arm problem. Also, it was the end of his contract with Baltimore, so he would retire at the age of 34. Now, he would get into sports casting, you know, would do a spot broadcast here or there for ABC television. But in 1983, he becomes the color commentator with the Cubs, where he would start a 14-year teammateship, if you will, with Harry Carey. I'm running out of words here. It's late in the podcast. He would start 14 consecutive years of working alongside Harry Carey. And that would happen, of course, up until Carey's death in 1998. Now, Stone would continue to be part of the Cubs broadcast with Chip Carey, which, of course, was Harry Carey's grandson in the 1998 and 99 seasons. Now, he had to step aside due to numerous health issues, notably kidney stones and valley fever, which he suffered in 2000, 2001, and 2002. He would eventually return to the Cubs booth in 2003 and 2004. Now, this is where Steve Stone gets into some trouble, and I think a lot of you may remember this. Stone was very critical of Cubs players, and this typically happens with former athletes who become color analysts. After time, they feel like, you know, they're not necessarily personally linked to a lot of the players. You know, a lot of the times when players become broadcasters, at first they're a little tentative to say anything that could be seen as, disparaging to the players, because they're still related. They're still known by the players. In some cases, they're still friends or enemies with the players. Well, by the year 2004, that is not the case. In fact, Steve Stone is very vocal against how poorly the Chicago Cubs are doing, and especially how poorly Dusty Baker was managing the team. And Moises Alou, Kent Merker, all did not like Steve Stone at all. And in fact, they tried to get Stone and Chip Carey banished from flying on the team charter. And at the end of the 2004 season, as the Cubs are letting a playoff opportunity slip away, Stone would just rip into the team. And he said, and I quote, and this is during a broadcast, by the way, "The truth of this situation is this is an extremely talented bunch of guys who want to look at all directions except where they should really look and kind of make excuses for what happened. This team should have won the wild card by 6-7 games, no doubt about it." And end quote. Obviously, the Cubs and Dusty Baker did not like that. And what do you know? All of a sudden, Steve Stone is not wanting to be associated with the Cubs anymore. Officially, he resigned, but I'm sure it was a suggested resignation. Now, in 2005, he would cross town, go back to the Chicago White Sox. This as a radio analyst with the White Sox, where he would team up with another Chicago legend, for good or for bad. He would team up with Hawk Harrelson, who, of course, retired following the 2020 season. But Steve Stone is still very much involved with the White Sox broadcast. He is also an author, penning a memoir of his days working along with Harry Carey in 1999, a book called Where's Harry? And if you were wondering who's Harry, if you pull out a Playgirl magazine from 1985, you will see Steve Stone towing the pitcher's rubber, to put it nicely. Yes, he did appear in that magazine, or so I have been told. Did not go looking for that rare sports collectible. But there you go, Steve Stone, a multi-sport. You know, normally when you're talking about these players, the multiple sports that they star in, you know, it's baseball and then maybe football or basketball. And then you've got, table tennis and some other sports too. So quite the all-round athlete, you know, with ping pong and other positions like that. Well, that is our look back at the bottom of the order there. Steve Stone, Jack McDowell, and Pat Mahomes Sr. in our look back at some of the traded updates and rookie sets, which all have a fantastic history behind them. And we're going to put this podcast behind us too. My thanks to you for listening to the podcast. Make sure you join us again 2 weeks from now, as we will be taking a look back at 72 Tops and its parallel set, the 2021 Tops Heritage set. And again, we'll try to reach out to Nick Deonte, our friend and Tops influencer, who will probably have some news about some of the Tops products that are coming out. And we'll talk about how the hobby has changed a lot, again, for better or for worse, since the COVID pandemic, because a lot of things have changed for better or for worse. And I'm happy to say I was finally able to corner some 2021 Top Series 1 cards at my local Walmart. I'm not really impressed with the cards, to be honest with you, but with all of the hype and some of the chase cards that are out there, you could see why they're so popular. So we'll talk a little bit about that with Nick in our next program. Don't forget, follow our new YouTube page, subscribe to the new Wax Ecstatic YouTube page. You can unsubscribe to the old one that's got my picture on it. Our new Wax Ecstatic email, waxandgumstains@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts, what have you. And we will be posting that new website, waxandgumstains.com, over the next few weeks. So look out for a survey asking you what you would want to see on that website. Again, we're still battling COVID. Make sure you wear those masks, wash your hands, socially distance yourself from your friends, and wait in line. We're all going to get our vaccines. Wait in line. And even if you're a little leery of vaccines, unless you really enjoy wearing masks everywhere and being holed up in your home, just get the damn vaccine, because we all want to try to get back to normal. And hopefully this summer is when it happens. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.